My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
It's The Wonky Show. We're in Munster talking drugs, the HE policy year ahead, UCAS end of cycle, and this extraordinary bus trip we're on. It's all coming up.
Now, we sort of know that the Conservative Party, from all the polling we get, has very little to offer millennials and under. I just about count as a millennial. And actually, in terms of the policy offers, in terms of higher education, I think they've made a calculation, clearly, of then we're not going to get those votes.
Yeah.
We'll try and get them somewhere else.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and joining me on this bus trip on our way through this week's HG policy news and also on our way through Europe are three fantastic guests in Munster. India Ellis is President at Lancaster SU. India, your highlight of the week?
My highlight of the week has been the sandwiches that I ate in Netherlands. Exceptional sandwich game in Netherlands, I've learned.
Alexander Robinson is President at Bath Students Union. Alexander, your highlight of the week?
It was meeting Arno, President of the Student Council at the University of Antwerp, where we tried some student-made beer.
And Gary Hughes is Chief Exec at Durham Students Union. Gary, your highlight of the week?
I'm going to give a bit of a shout-out to something happening back at home. Jack Durham, SU's Opportunities Officer, has written a lovely article about how actually working has actually made the Freedom of Speech Bill a little bit better, and it's really lovely to actually come back after the new year and read something nice.
So yes, we start this week with drugs. At the weekend, well, actually, Alex, you explain.
Well, the Times had a preview of the University's UK Task Force on Student Drug Use, looking at whether they're going to start having a well-being approach rather than punitive to student drug use on campus.
I mean, can you imagine the headlines? It's going to be an absolute free-for-all. I mean, I think, to be fair, the Times article was a fairly decent setup. Like, when we see the report, it'll be informed. I think the important thing for me is that this is a new UK report. Like, Nick Beach at Middlesex has chaired the task force. It has credible academics on, credible sector support. And we're led to believe that that the country wants evidence-informed policy from universities making a real contribution to the way in which people's lives are made better. I think this is what that looks like. Now, I really encourage people to look at who sits on that task force. You can really have great confidence in the contributions made. It has people who are absolutely qualified to comment on as of harm reduction, on matters of health, on the ways in which policy and regulation work. I think it would be really easy to fall into a trap of zero tolerance without thinking what that means. It would be really easy to think about encouraging, you know, it's a gateway. The minute you start saying we will tolerate people who smoke cannabis in Freshers' Week, the next step is international drug barons opening up a pop-up shop at Freshers' Week and people signing up for the cocaine club. It's ludicrous. I think the confidence we should have in the people producing the report should see us well clear of all of that.
I'm not entirely sure how much our institutions in the United Kingdom are to taking the risks around having that kind of approach. I think that realistically, there are always going to be students that use drugs at university. And the minute that that begins to go wrong, we should be creating environments as higher education institutions where they feel they're able to speak to people who can help them about that rather than hide it until it gets worse. I feel like the whole zero tolerance thing is a bit dated, and you know, if universities UK have actually come out and said this, then why shouldn't we follow suit?
At Bath now, the SU does drug testing. The senior leadership, you know, realise at the university that people will continue to take drugs. Guidance from the UK will allow vice chancellors and senior leadership to go with this institution that says, you know, we're all going to do this together. Let's make a change rather than have to be the first ones to do it. And risk alienating themselves.
Okay, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
For many of us working in higher education, one of the surprising things that happened in the later months of 2022 was suddenly seeing subject benchmark statements feature in the headlines of the national press. Benchmark statements have been around for over 20 years. For many of us, they have long been part of the furniture of the reference points we use in designing our programmes. The benchmarks are clearly labelled as reference points, not requirements or a national curriculum, but clearly some colleagues do not feel that this is the case. Why? At least part of the answer perhaps lies in the history of subject benchmarks and the multiple ways in which they've been used within universities. While the benchmarks are reference points, not requirements, when they are used in universities, they also become political documents, used in particular ways for particular purposes. The practice in some cases, the lived experience, varies from what the intention is of the subject benchmarks. We need to think about this and its implication for the way that we use the benchmarks. Doing so might also give us some insight into some aspects of the most recent overhaul of the National Arrangements of Quality and Standards in England, conducted by the OFS.
So this morning we've managed to find ourselves in Utrecht, and there are all sorts of people with us. Give introduce yourselves, Shifri.
Well, my name is Laura, and I'm one of the board members from one of the student representative organisations.
My name is Johan, and I'm also a board member of another national student representative, and that's the NSRB.
Hi, I'm Leap. I'm also a board member at a national student representation organisation, PISO.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. Each of you gets to talk about one issue facing students that you think is really important, and that means the person who goes last, you'll have to think on your feet.
I think I'll pick the cherry right now. Student well-being is a big issue in the Netherlands. Well-being, and over half of Dutch students have mental issues regarding loneliness or depressive feeling, and that's one thing we also want to do a lot about. So students can live a happy life, but also after this time.
And do you have a clear sense of what is causing that? Was it COVID? Is it something else? You know, what is the, do you know what's causing it?
I believe that COVID has made a lot of issues that were there already visible.
Right.
And a lot of issues have been caused by the situation of students, the financial position, housing position. But also the pressure of getting through your education as quick as possible and not taking your time when you need it, and the focus on results instead of the study success.
Well, I think there's also an issue of students not being enabled to actually participate with what we call medeseffes hop. So that's just active student life outside of your study. So doing board years, or what you call, I think, sabbaticals years. There are all of these issues with only being able to do that when you have money, because it costs lots of money because of the system. So I think that's also an issue we're facing. Yeah, because they, again, only a super specific group of people that you are hearing from, while the group is much more there.
Yeah, so not only do the benefits of taking part not flow equally to students, the universities only hear from people who...
I'm really passionate about that social safety for students. It's not great in the Netherlands. And actually, for too long, I don't think it's gotten the priority that it needs. And it's been treated as a support student well-being. And obviously, it has a big implications on your well-being. But finally, we're seeing policy specific to how to create a safe student environment. And for me, it's just reading all these reports and... There's so much to do, and
And then obviously the thing I must ask you about quickly is the thing we have noticed is the Minister for Higher Education saying don't recruit any more international students. Why? Why? What's happened there?
Internationalization is a big challenge in the Netherlands. The problem is that as a university, when you have a higher percentage of the students, you get more money. So there's a bigger incentive to recruit more students, and international students are a really big source. So what we see is that universities get really crowded. And the difficult part is that you don't want to demonize international students. And on the other hand, unlimited internationalization is also a big burden for those international students.
Now, on the site this week, we've been thinking about the HE policy year ahead. Gary, tell us more.
Well, it's January, isn't it, Jim? It's the January when you think about planning, you think ahead. It would be really nice if everything wasn't so chaotic, wouldn't it? So you could actually base your analysis on the year ahead on any form of predictability in either national, international, sector, student affairs. If only we had that luxury. What I found really interesting on the site that I absolutely agree is going to be something where I just do not know how the sector is going to respond in the year. But the site really helpfully sets out the problems, doesn't it, with policy people to think about what could happen is housing. I think I can't be the only one thing that we've come to an impasse where we've just stated the problem and now we're just trying to think about what are the causes and therefore what are the solutions. I think the site really well puts it, you need to get less people coming in, more houses built. Or make different choices about how you construct your university. I think the interesting thing, and the reason I mentioned it as my top thing that I'm thinking about in the year ahead, is that, of course, the intersection between what Department for Housing, the way that local communities are thinking about housing planning, the way in which the Department for Education thinks about planning. What we know from our trip is that the Netherlands, the Minister for Education has written to universities across the Netherlands saying, can you stop recruiting international students? Now, I had dinner the other night and sat next to a senior manager from the University of Amsterdam who was talking about the fact that they're already here to a great extent. And actually, you've encouraged us for so many years to build a model that relies upon this. And actually, we're universities, we're not housing suppliers for the most part. I mean, she had a long list of all the policy conditions in the Netherlands that have led to effectively students not having housing. And she turned to me and just went, you know, I'm sure you can't be late. And it's like, no, actually, yes. It's shocking. So I think the it's fascinating for this podcast because it's policy conditions, isn't it? It's not like people have suddenly decided to move to Durham. You know, they were very happy living in Cardiff and they decided to move to Durham. They've been brought to Durham. And actually, in terms of the policy conditions that created people queuing outside agents overnight, that's not an accident. That's choice. So I think in the year ahead, and you've got different choices will be made. And I think that is why it's such a fascinating policy question.
The cost of living crisis is not going anywhere anytime soon. I think that the increase on the maintenance loan for next year is nothing short of an insult. And I can't even begin to fathom with my little brain, even when I put it into full-scale sabbatical officer mode, what we can begin to do to alleviate how difficult it's going to be for students next year. I think that, you know, it's coming from all directions. They're going to be, what was it, £1,500 worse off in real terms next year. And then add to that the issue of, oh my goodness me, I don't know if I can find a house. And the ones that I can find are absolutely ridiculously expensive. You also add into that the complexity of student letting contracts are now for sort of taking out those all-inclusive bills offers and saying, right, students, sort it out yourselves, which with how expensive energy bills are getting, it's very cheeky from the letting agents, and it's also very, very bad and scary for students because they can't afford it. And even those that are keeping the inclusive bills offer, they're getting hit with ridiculous, ridiculous bills for thousands of pounds because they've gone over their energy caps and they didn't even know that they had energy caps.
I think there's a whole range, especially the cost of living means a lot more students are worth it. A lot more students are trying to fit around when they study, around their jobs. The structures over here explicitly allow students to say how much of their degree they want to do this semester. I want to, you know, be studying 75% of the time and the rest of it I'm going to volunteer, I'm going to run this organisation, I'm going to help my fellow students study this module because I want to do it. That just doesn't exist.
Government, effectively, if we focus on the one we've got for the time being, is in a really interesting conundrum to sketch together the votes it can get. Now, we sort of know that the Conservative Party, from all the polling we get, has very little to offer millennials and under. I just about count as a millennial. And actually, in terms of the policy office, in terms of higher education, I think they've made a calculation, clearly, of then we're not going to get those votes.
Yeah.
We'll try and get them somewhere else. You know, their focus is schools and further education. The Labour Party, to be fair, is probably making a similar calculation that they can rely upon millennial and young people votes for other reasons, because I think, you know, we have to bear in mind the students are students, but they also live in rural communities and they want kids and they want houses. They're not single-issue people. But the Labour Party has made a calculation and they can rely upon those votes. So in terms of higher education, it sort of feels like the policy area that neither side sees votes in. It would be really interesting, therefore, to see that they weren't relying upon the sector so much to drive economic recovery or to compensate for the fact that the NHS can't deliver psychological support for young people and that local authorities can't deliver housing for young people. I think two things are really interesting to me. One of which is, again, like him that much, but Jack, my opportunities officer, at the Labour Party conference, referred back to the fact that the Labour Party policy mandate at the last conference didn't mention higher education. And he stood up and went, can we just, Bridget, take this back? Like, you need to do some thinking. And then this week, I saw on the socials that the Labour Students Committee and a number of Labour clubs effectively said, are you still committed to tuition fees? And that's to abolishing tuition fees. And that's an old debate. I've got my own views on it. But I find it very interesting that young people are mobilising. So in terms of a general election coming up, and particularly as it relates to higher education, I think what I'm finding interesting is the silence. There's no votes there. You know, Matt Weston, Robert Halfen are talking about other things, further education and what actually gives people skills for life, employability, lifelong learning, da-da-da. If you're an 18 to 21-year-old looking for residential experience, I think there is a calculation that your votes have been assessed, they've been weighed, we know where they're going, we're not competing for you, we're competing for other things. So unfortunately, we've got to agitate as a sector for where we fit into the manifestos, how much of the pie are we going to get after Starmer takes power, potentially. And we're competing with so many other things. So I will be very interested in the long run up to the general election, how vice chancellors effectively make the calculation that silence is not an option. And actually, in terms of students who have traditionally said, this is our manifesto, this is what we stand for, UUK, I think, are going to have to get dirty. Well, they're going to have to realise they are not going to invite people to dinner at high table. Like, Matt Weston is going to go for much rather have a dinner cooked at University College Birmingham by some wonderful apprentices than he's going to come to Durham for a high table. And I don't think they're prepared for that. And we're going to have 18 months of vice-chancellors fighting, I think, for attention.
Now, UCAS end of cycle data came out this week and DK was all over the tableau.
It's UCAS end of cycle time again, so there's tons of data on Wonky in two articles that I urge you strongly to go and have a look at if you haven't already. The 2022 cycle has seen the return of conversations about capacity. For about the last decade, in England at least, there's been no centrally set student number controls, meaning we've had the impression that the capacity for the sector to take in new students is basically limitless. But the combination of two bumper years of higher than expected recruitment after changes to A-level marking and a unit of resource per student that is shrinking in real terms mean that for many subject areas and many providers, we're rapidly reaching a limit of what we can fit in. The perception here has been that academically able, advantaged students applying to high status courses have been the ones to lose out. In actual fact, this week's data shows that this is not the case if we take polar quintiles as the proxy. There is some evidence of some more selective providers making the choice to contract undergraduate recruitment, but there were six members of the Russell Group, including Cambridge, that saw England-domiciled 18-year-old numbers increase between 2021 and 2022. And there was one provider, which I shan't name here, that has nearly doubled in size between 2019 and 2022. The evidence seems to point to a return to a trend, with comparisons to 2019 showing mild expansion in most of the cases. Subject trends have proven to be very dependent on providers. The gross in healthcare recruitment, for instance, does not hold in all cases, and there is no obvious pattern as to who is up and who is down. We are seeing a lot of what we might call churn in creative arts recruitment, with some small providers leaving the subject area entirely and others joining. However, the trend here in large providers is generally positive. Offer making remains a law unto itself, with all kinds of insights into university strategic thinking available. And we've got data on acceptances by type of qualification, which reveals that in many places, A-levels are in the minority for students entering a university or higher education provider. Do have a dive into the data visualization. This is your chance to get in deep, not just with your provider's data, but the data of every provider in the sector. And do leave us a comment and let us know what you've spotted. There's tons of stuff in there.
Now, we've obviously been on this trip around Belgium, the Netherlands and Germany with a whole bunch of student leaders and the staff that support them this week, what were some of the things that have stuck out for you?
We went to the Free University of Brussels on our first day. And I'm sure we all work in places where our universities say they're values-driven institutions. And despite the fact that, you know, you've got Durham, the Open University, Norwich University of Arts, they're all the same for the most part. And indeed, the Free University of Brussels had, you know, people and planet and punctuality. Like, there were five P's. But the sixth P was, I'm going to say this wrong, Poincaré. Who my president Joe was with me, he's a mathematician, and I was stunned he knew who it was. He's a mathematician from the area. And the university articulate that one of their values is a philosophy, it's a theory, it's an organisation with a not just a set of pleasing adjectives that describe what it does. And underneath it, this lad had given a speech years ago about education is nothing if it bows to pressure. The fact speaks for itself. We are curious, open, inquiring minds. And the reason I find it interesting is I work at Durham, Free Speech Ground Zero, where actually it's viewed as value neutral. Like, actually, the ability to shout abuse is as good as the ability to make a meaningful, thoughtful contribution in philosophy and theology or whatever. And I just find it fascinating that someone just went, no, it's got to be good free speech. It's got to be like academic endeavor. We're not just like Breitbart or The Tab. So actually, a university saying, you know, we're here to be clever. It's an artistic university. We spoke to the student leader there who told us about his baptism. You know, we might speak about that in a bit. But he was just so ingrained in the life of the university because they were trying to be creative.
I have been completely amazed by the way that they allow their students to just do things and do things properly here. So rather than, you know, expecting six people who've either taken a year out of their degree or finished their degree and decided to stick around for a bit to do absolutely everything, which is just never going to work, they seem to quite neatly, especially in the Netherlands, split that up into education policy, which is done by the university council, the student council, and then you've got your activities that's done by the student associations, and then that frees up the students' unions to do the activism, to do the politics, and to actually, you know, get a bit down and dirty. Everywhere we've been in Netherlands, they've just been talking about protests and strikes and sit-ins and occupations. They love a protest here. Well, not here, we're in Germany now. But yeah, it's blown my mind.
And I do find it interesting, India. I wonder if you agree that I think tying together two of your points that I've come on some of these trips before, like I quite often do this podcast on the trip away. And I'm fascinated by the fact that in the UK, we're really centralised. We don't have that local government that Alex spoke about. So we think that everything needs to be run by one group that knows what it's doing. Like, we need somebody who is the decision maker, and there's only one, and that's it.
Where's the top of this tree?
So in our student unions, in our universities even, like, there's an executive, there's a VC, or there's a student union president, or there's a senate or whatever. And everything flows to there. There's a bit of a fight, and then a decision comes out. Whereas because here they're federal or they're much more municipal, because of their heritage, their culture, they're not just being run by Westminster. That actually, like, their VCs have to fight out an election. Like, they have a council in the University of Amsterdam, who, as I said, I spoke to. They have a staff elected body and a student elected body, and they both have a separate veto on the institutional budget. Like, they're just a bit messier, and they're used to things having power that isn't executive. I mean, on the plus side, they seem to get little done quickly. but I just find it really interesting about actually they've grown from where they are, and we come on these trips and go, well, we could copy that, and we can't. We just don't have the culture.
There's a real opportunity. Now, I don't think we could move to a model like this overnight or in a decade or however long it is. I think students take on more ownership and more control of their education on these activities that are education. Yes, it may be learning some mad curriculum, but what we felt for all the student associations here was that they had real power. They got to decide their own budget, they got to decide this, and they weren't allowed to fail. And I think that's really important, that there's no one holding their hand through it.
Yeah, interesting, because all three of you use the word allow.
Yeah.
And if someone can actually, like, I will permit you to do that. And actually, there's no question of it. So today we all went to the University of Twente, probably saying that wrong. Dutch is a very hard language. But they had a phenomenal thing called Create Tomorrow, where a group of students on their own have created a hundreds of thousands of euro event Not that matters, but just to give you a sense of the size of it, where students craft creative problems to actually important industrial and social problems. And some companies adopt it, like they win a prize, but they didn't ask permission. Like, there was nobody to ask permission of. Like, the student union didn't allow them. The student just went, I'm doing this, yeah. And they rent a space in the SU, and there's a dialogue around rent. I was fascinated to find out the SU doesn't charge them rent. They just take services. But they also do problem solving for the SU. But allow, like, we say that because that's what we think we do. But actually, particularly at our institutions where our students have a lot of social capital, like, we couldn't stop them if we wanted to. But in the Netherlands, it's just like, and Belgium, to be fair, it's just natural that I'm going to do this.
I think the professional services that we offer at our universities are, you know, some of the best things about them, actually. And I do think that there's a lot of benefit in finding that nice middle ground between how it works in the Netherlands and how it works at home, where students are able to, you know, have that professional support and really, really benefit from those incredibly skilled and knowledgeable people that find themselves in those jobs, but then also have that freedom to, you know, not have to ask permission to do this thing or not have to be allowed to take a bit of time away from their degree to do something else. I think that something that did strike us today actually was that these student boards of the students' unions here, they take the year out of their studies, but they don't get paid for that. They can take a loan from the government of £10,000.
They have more student debt.
And yeah, they add more student debt on just to, you know, run the organisations that they care about. And that's, you know, that in itself is amazing. But for me, as a low-income background student, that's a bit like, oh my goodness me, I don't think I'd ever be able to afford to do that. So yeah, I think there must be that sort of sweet middle point between focusing on widening participation, but also enabling this incredible student participation that they have here.
I think it's seeing that student decision making on every level is into seeing how at the board level, at committee level, it's not tokenistic, it's real student input.
I saw at Amsterdam that they call legal advice to students actually something that they support student volunteers who are studying law to give students basic answers to things that are just what does this contract word mean? That doesn't need the over-professionalisation point. An actual lawyer, it needs a good-hearted volunteer to just go, I'll explain it to you. And I think I'm going to go back and talk about how we can help volunteers do that.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKIG, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Alex, Gary, India, and our news editor, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. Until next week, stay wonky.